All right, welcome everyone to another deep dive. Today we're taking a look at a case that I think really gets to the heart of how our regulatory system works, you know, especially when you've got multiple government agencies involved.
Absolutely.
So we're going to be talking about National Mining Association v. McCarthy.
Yeah.
And for all of you law students out there listening, think of this as like a core case, one that really sheds light on some of the fundamental principles of administrative law. We're going to be zeroing in on the EPA, how agencies work together, and when you can actually take a case to court to challenge what an agency is doing.
You got it. And it's a case that really provides some key insights into how different agencies and the courts interact with each other. So we'll be focusing specifically on actions taken by the EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers when it comes to issuing permits for surface coal mining. And of course, the big decisions that came out of the DC Circuit Court of Appeals.
Okay, so let's break this down. You know, our mission today is to really dissect this case and figure out what it all means. We'll look at the background of the case, the big legal questions that came up about the EPA and the Army Corps' role in these mining permits, and then finally, what the DC Circuit ultimately decided. So specifically, we want to understand, when can agencies coordinate their efforts, even if Congress hasn't explicitly told them to? And when does something an agency puts out there, even if they call it guidance, become something you can actually challenge in court?
Exactly right. And we've got some great resources today that dive into the specifics of this case, the legal arguments that were made, and how the court reasoned its way through it all. So by the time we're done here, you should have a much clearer picture of these essential administrative law concepts and why this case in particular is still so relevant today.
Perfect. So let's start by setting the scene. What exactly led to this legal battle in the first place? What were the National Mining Association and these other groups who sued so worried about?
Well, as you can see in the materials, we've got surface coal mining, especially in places like Appalachia. It's a huge industry.
Oh, yeah.
But it also, you know, comes with some pretty serious environmental consequences. Congress knew that, and that's why they set up this whole system of permits. It involves both the Clean Water Act, where the EPA has a big part to play, and then the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act.
Mm-hmm.
The main problem was that the EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers, who also have some say under the Clean Water Act, well, they started doing a couple of things that really got the mining industry in several states riled up.
And those things were what they called the enhanced coordination process and the final guidance, right? Can you walk us through what each of those actually involve?
You got it. So the first one, the Enhanced Coordination Process, or ECP for short, was this agreement they made official back in 2009 between the EPA and the Army Corps. The idea was to make the whole process of reviewing permits under Section 404 of the Clean Water Act. That's the part that deals with dumping dredged or fill material into waterways, specifically when it came to surface coal mining. They wanted to streamline that whole process. Then in 2011, the EPA put out what they called their final guidance. This document basically gave recommendations for tougher water quality standards that everyone should consider when they're issuing permits under Section 402, which is the part of the Clean Water Act that regulates just general discharges of pollutants.
Got it. So it sounds like the mining companies in the states were thinking, hold on, the EPA is stepping outside of its lane here, legally speaking.
Yeah, that was their big argument.
Right.
They said the ECP basically gave the EPA this veto power over permit decisions that should have been totally up to the Army Corps. And they argued that the final guidance, even though they called it guidance, was basically forcing everyone to follow these stricter rules.
Oh.
And get this, the case first went to a district court, and they actually sided with the mining industry in the states. But then, like you said, the DC Circuit Court of Appeals took a look at it and came to a completely different conclusion. They reversed the lower court's decision.
Interesting. Okay, so the DC Circuit steps in with a fresh perspective. What were the big legal questions that they had to grapple with in this case?
Well, their analysis really boiled down to two main questions. First, they had to look at whether this enhanced coordination process went beyond what the EPA was actually allowed to do under the Clean Water Act. In other words, did the EPA even have the legal right to set up this whole coordinated review system with the Army Corps? And second, they had to decide whether this final guidance from the EPA was actually a final agency action, which, you know, in legal terms means, is it something that can be challenged in court right now?
Right, right.
This whole idea of when an agency's action is considered final, that's a super important part of administrative law. It basically determines when you're allowed to file a lawsuit saying, hey, what the agency did is wrong.
So what did the D.C. Circuit decide on these two big questions?
Well, on the first question about the enhanced coordination process, they said it was totally legal. Their reasoning was that the Clean Water Act doesn't specifically say that the EPA and the Army Corps can't work together on permit decisions. In fact, they pointed out that when different agencies have responsibilities that kind of overlap, Congress often expects them to work together to actually achieve what the law is trying to do. So for you future lawyers out there, this is a big principle in administrative law. Agencies usually have these implied powers, you know, things they can do to help them carry out their duties, especially when those powers make things more efficient and don't directly conflict with what Congress clearly intended.
Yeah, that makes sense. You wouldn't want agencies dealing with related issues to just be working in silos, right?
Exactly. And then their second reason for upholding the ECP was that it didn't actually take away any real decision-making power from the Army Corps. The Army Corps still had the final say on whether to issue a permit or not. The EPA was just giving their expert opinion as part of the review process. Kind of like when you go to the doctor, if you get a second opinion from a specialist, it doesn't mean your primary care doctor suddenly can't decide on your treatment anymore. They're just getting more information to make a better decision.
So it's more like the EPA was playing an advisory role in the ECP, not like they were calling all the shots.
Right. That's a good way to put it. Now, their third reason for upholding the ECP gets a little more interesting. It has to do with this legal idea called the doctrine of constitutional avoidance. What they're basically saying is, look, if we were to read the Clean Water Act in a way that prevented this kind of interagency coordination, it could actually raise some constitutional questions about the president's power to oversee and direct executive branch agencies.
Mm. That's a whole other can of worms, isn't it? So the court wasn't just looking at the Clean Water Act in isolation. They were thinking about how their decision could affect bigger constitutional principles about how the entire executive branch works.
Exactly. And in his opinion, then Judge Kavanaugh really emphasized this idea of agencies having some freedom to decide their own procedures. He pointed out that agencies generally get to choose their own internal rules for how they operate, and they don't always have to go through that super formal process of notice and comment rulemaking just to set up these kinds of coordination efforts. The court basically saw the ECP as a rule about how permits are reviewed, not as some brand new substantive regulation.
Got it. That distinction between procedural rules and substantive regulations seems pretty crucial here. And I think there was a specific quote from the opinion that really drove this point home about not assuming that Congress wanted to limit consultation between agencies.
Oh, absolutely. They said, and I quote, "We will not read into the statute an implicit intent to restrict consultation between executive agencies." So they were very clear that they're not going to just assume Congress wanted to prevent agencies from working together if the law doesn't explicitly say so.
All right, let's switch gears now and talk about that final guidance. We know the court decided it wasn't ready for a legal challenge at that point. What was the legal basis for that decision? What's the key legal standard here that we should be aware of?
The core concept is this idea of a final agency action. The Supreme Court, in a case called Bennett v. Speer, they laid out the criteria for what makes an agency's action final so that a court can review it. Basically, for it to be considered final and ready for a court challenge, it has to impose some kind of legally binding obligation or consequence. In the case of the EPA's final guidance, the D.C. Circuit decided it just didn't meet that bar. Think of it this way. If the EPA sends out a memo saying they prefer companies to do something, that's just like their opinion.
Right.
But if they issue a rule saying companies must do something specific or face penalties, that's a final agency action with some real teeth.
Okay, so even though they called it final guidance, it wasn't actually final in the eyes of the law, meaning you couldn't immediately run to court to challenge it.
Exactly. The court said that by its very nature, guidance is just guidance. It might suggest or recommend stricter water quality standards for those Section 402 permits, but it didn't actually require states to adopt those standards.
Mm.
And in the court's view, states could wholly ignore the guidance without getting into any legal trouble.
So it was more like a set of friendly suggestions rather than a hard and fast rule book then.
Exactly. It was considered advisory. And the court made it very clear that until the EPA actually denies a specific permit to a mining company, because that company's plans don't line up with the recommendations and the guidance, there's no real concrete harm for a court to step in and fix. It's only when that guidance is actually used to make a binding decision, like denying a permit, that it might become something a court can review.
I see. So from the court's perspective, there needs to be an actual problem, a real case or controversy before they'll jump in. But that seems kind of tough for the mining companies, doesn't it? They have this guidance hanging over their heads, potentially influencing decisions, but they can't challenge whether it's even legal until someone actually uses it against them.
That's a great point, and it really highlights this tension that exists in administrative law. The whole idea of preventing lawsuits over policies that aren't binding yet, that's meant to stop courts from getting bogged down with challenges to every little piece of advice an agency gives out. Yeah. But it does create this weird situation where companies might feel like they have to comply with guidance, even if it's not legally required, just to avoid problems or delays down the line.
Right, just to be on the safe side.
Exactly.
And I remember there was a very specific quote from the court's opinion that really highlighted this, about the guidance not creating any obligations, and states being free to ignore it without facing consequences.
Oh yeah, they were very explicit. They said, the guidance imposes no obligations. State authority is free to ignore it without legal consequences. That really sums up why they decided the guidance wasn't a final agency action that was ready for a court challenge at that point.
Okay, so let's zoom out a bit. What are the big picture implications of this case for administrative law? What fundamental principles does National Mining Association v. McCarthy really reinforce for us?
There are a couple of key takeaways here. First, as we've been talking about, it really underscores that agencies have some flexibility in how they handle their procedures. They can often work together with other agencies and set up internal processes to get things done without always having to go through all the hoops of formal rulemaking, like the notice and comment process. This basically lets agencies be more efficient and adaptable when they're putting laws into action.
So they have some leeway to figure out how they'll work together on a practical level.
Exactly. The second big takeaway is this idea of judicial restraint when it comes to reviewing guidance documents that aren't legally binding. Courts generally won't step in to review these kinds of policy statements, and they actually have some real enforceable effect in the world. And the reason for that is to prevent the courts from getting tied up in a bunch of early fights over agency statements that don't really have the force of law yet.
But doesn't that bring us back to that whole problem of regulation by suggestion? You know, agencies using guidance that's not legally binding to still influence how companies and states behave.
Oh, that's a very astute observation. You're right. While the court's position definitely helps things run smoothly and avoids unnecessary lawsuits, it does raise some valid concerns. Agencies could theoretically use non-binding guidance as a way to indirectly control what people do without going through the more transparent and rigorous process of formal rulemaking. It's something to be mindful of when you're trying to understand the regulatory landscape.
Absolutely. So what's the main practical lesson here for someone who might find themselves arguing a case against a government agency someday? What's the big takeaway from National Mining Association in that context?
I'd say the biggest lesson is this. When you're dealing with agency actions, timing is everything. If you try to challenge a guidance document or some other policy that isn't binding before it's actually been used against your client in a way that has legal consequences, your case is probably going to get tossed out. The court will likely say it's not right for review or that they don't have jurisdiction.
So you can't just jump the gun, legally speaking.
No. Usually you have to wait until something concrete has happened, like a permit denial or an enforcement action that actually hurts your client based on that guidance.
So patience is a virtue, especially when you're going up against government agencies.
Absolutely. You typically need to wait for that non-binding guidance to actually have a real binding effect before you can expect a court to side with you.
All right. So just to recap, National Mining Association v. McCarthy gives us some much needed clarity on a couple of key areas in administrative law.
Yeah.
It confirms that agencies are allowed to coordinate their processes, even if Congress hasn't specifically authorized it. And it sets a clear bar for when those non-binding agency guidance documents become something you can challenge in court.
Precisely. The court basically said that agencies have the freedom to figure out how to work together internally, but also their actions generally need to have a real, concrete legal impact before someone can take them to court over it. It's a landmark case for understanding that delicate balance between giving agencies some independence and making sure the courts can keep them in check.
Well, thanks for taking the time to break down this complex case for us. It really gives us a lot to think about when it comes to how the administrative state actually functions.
You're very welcome. It's a case with lots of layers, and understanding those layers is crucial for anyone who wants to be successful in navigating administrative law.
So, for all of you listening out there, here's a final thought to chew on. We've talked a lot about these non-binding guidance documents and how they can influence things, even though they don't have the force of law. But think about this. How much do these guidance documents really shape behavior and policy in the real world? Even if states and companies technically could ignore them, does the fact that the EPA has put out this guidance, for example, make them more likely to comply anyway? It makes you wonder about the real-world impact of these seemingly toothless pronouncements and what it all means for our regulatory system and the rule of law in general.
It really does.
All right, that's all the time we have for today's deep dive. We'll see you next time.
Take care.
Bye.